Disc 8.
Chapter 13. Like Hell with the Fire Out. They are saying the generals learned their lesson in the last war. There are going to be no wholesale slaughters. I ask, how is victory possible except by wholesale slaughters? Evelyn Waugh, in his 1939 diary. Harold Keller could not know how right he was. He was peering through his lens into bad territory, an open furnace of violence that would soon beggar the suffering and dying thus far. No one could have predicted the horrors to come. In fact, much of the world would assume, given 4,574 U.S. casualties and the triumphal raising of the American colors on February 23rd, that the Battle of Iwo Jima was over. In fact, the reverse was closer to the truth. For Easy Company and for many thousands of other Marines, the real Battle of Iwo Jima was only about to begin. Dearest Mother, Harlan wrote to Bell and Weslaco early on March 1st, the day of Easy Company's plunge into the asylum. Just a few lines to let you know I'm okay. I came through without a scratch. Oh yes, I saw Carl Sims just before we hit. He is okay. I guess you're pretty anxious to hear from me by this time. This isn't much, but it's all I could get. I will write more later. The real battle would be waged exactly on General Kurabayashi's terms. It would be a battle of attrition, on terrain that had no front lines, where the attackers were exposed and the defenders fortified, where Japanese infiltrators stalked the night, where every rock, every ditch, every open stretch of ground could conceal a burrowing, suicidal enemy, and where brave Marines trained to advance despite any conditions and all losses would advance yard by bloody yard for four more hellacious weeks until the smell of death staggered the burial crews and the survivors on both sides resembled ragged phantoms more than living, vital young men. They would advance and die, largely bereft of their nation's good wishes or sympathy. Attention had now begun to shift away from Iwo Jima, even as the great bulk of the bloodletting began. The flag raising on Suribachi had given the press corps a convenient symbol of a happy ending. Some 70 war correspondents had accompanied the armada to the island. For the first drama-soaked week, they had remained on the scene and sent hundreds of thousands of words back to their newspapers, magazines, and radio networks, not to mention countless photographs and newsreel images. But now the majority of these seemed to consider the story over. Having badly distorted the facts of the ascent of Suribachi and having fatally garbled the true story of the flag raisings from the safety of their distant ships, the gentlemen of the press, or most of them, withdrew. There were other war zones to inspect, other exotic locales for their datelines. Now the agony would have its veil of privacy. Now the valor would go uncelebrated. Easy Company, reunited with its patrol that descended Suribachi the night before, was ready to join the great offensive on the northern plateau. Now the dying would begin in earnest. Easy plunged into action with the rest of the 28th Marines along the island's embattled west coast, in the 5th Division zone of operations. It was nasty business. The terrain, rocky plateaus abutting on steep cliffs, shallow ravines, like hell with the fire out, in the words of one correspondent, offered the usual absence of cover. The 28th threw all three of its battalions onto the line, and the hidden Japanese gunners resumed their harvest. Easy had to cross rough, exposed ground against a heavily fortified ridge. The Japanese ordnance showed no respect for heroes. Among the first to get hit was Chuck Lindbergh, shot through the arm. Doc Bradley was instantly at his side. "The only time I saw your dad on Iwo, he was running," Pee-wee Griffiths told me. "Somebody was screaming, and he was running." The heroic flamethrower's war was over. He was evacuated from the island. A few minutes later, Mike Strank's dark prophecy came true. Mike was leading Ira, Harlan, Franklin, and some other Marines across a dangerous strip of ground when a cluster of Japanese snipers opened up on them. Jesse Boatwright took a bullet in the stomach, a non-lethal wound, but enough to slam him into a shell hole. His buddies scrambled for cover. Mike and some others dove behind an outcropping that seemed to give them solid protection from three sides. Its only exposure was toward the sea, where the American destroyers lay at anchor. As sniper fire continued to rake the area, Mike sized up the situation with a veterans detachment. Pee-wee Griffiths, L.B. Holly, and Franklin bent toward their leader, awaiting orders. Mike talked to them about possible escape routes. Then he seemed to drift into a private place. He broke his own silence after a moment with a cryptic remark to L.B. "You know, Holly, that's going to be one hell of an experience." L.B. waited for him to continue, then finally asked, "What are you talking about?" Mike did not reply. He only pointed to a dead Marine who sprawled a few feet from the group. "He was telling me he would die," Holly reflected many years later. And sure enough, 2 minutes later, Mike was dead. Joe Rodriguez watched it happen at close range. He was nearly killed himself. "Mike hollered at me to come over," he recalled. He was on one knee with Franklin and the other guys around, getting ready to draw a plan in the sand to get us out of there, but before he could get a word out, a shell exploded. Franklin and Holly were bowled over by the blast, but were uninjured. Pee-wee was hit in the face and shoulder and temporarily blinded. Rodriguez woke up a few seconds later with a warm feeling in my chest, unable to move my legs. Mike Strank did not wake up. The shell got Mike where he gave it. The impact tore a hole in his chest and ripped out his heart. No Japanese could claim credit for this kill. Almost certainly the round had come from a U.S. destroyer offshore. It sliced through the only unprotected side of the outcropping. The Czech immigrant to America, born on the Marine Corps birthday, serving his third tour of duty for his adopted country, the sergeant who was a friend to his boys, was cut down by friendly fire. Melvin Duncan, just 19, reached down and cradled Mike in his arms. Now, at 72, Melvin's emotional comment recalls the esteem he and the others felt for Sergeant Mike. "If there had been some way I could have died in his place, I would have done it." L.B. Holly gently replaced Mike's helmet on his head and whispered to the lifeless form, "Mike, you're the best damn Marine I ever knew." Then Holly took Mike's watch off and gave it to Harlan, who had idolized Mike. Now Harlan was Mike, the squad leader. And then the war went on. Progress was slow and lethal across the rocky, windswept plain. The 28th had moved out at 9 a.m. By 9:30, it was taking harassing fire from the rear. 700 yards inland on a front that ranged from 200 to 500 yards wide, the regiment was caught in a harsh landscape of outcroppings and ravines. Below the surface was the labyrinth of caves and tunnels. As one combatant later wrote, "If a heavy aerial bomb happened to hit an entrance, smoke would puff out of the other entrances, sometimes an astonishing distance away." The 28th was pinned down for 4 hours, its crouching boys getting picked off with sickening regularity before it could start moving again. And movement without cover offered only more danger. Easy, strung out in a long line, scampered across the hard rock toward the island's northern tip. The gunfire directed at them was intermittent but deadly. My father was following Hank Hansen across a crust of exposed ground when he saw Hank crumple up. No one had heard a shot, and at first Doc thought the sergeant had tripped and fallen. But Hansen did not get back up, and as the other Marines scattered, Doc ran to him and pulled him into a nearby shell crater. The bullet had entered Hansen's back and exited through his abdomen. "It was a bad wound," my father told a magazine interviewer a few months later, "but one thing you learn out there is not to give up. I yelled for somebody to hold the plasma bottle while I put a battle dressing on. For me, it was the luckiest thing I ever did." Hansen was dying, but Doc's cry for assistance saved his own life. Tex Hips came sliding into the crater to assist the corpsman. Then he glanced over Doc's shoulder and shouted, "Watch out, Bradley!" Four Japanese, one brandishing a sword, were charging him, screaming, "Banzai!" Hips dropped the sword-wielding officer and one soldier with his M1. The other two retreated. Now two Marines came tearing onto the scene, hurling grenades at the Japanese who were disappearing into a hole. After it was cleaned out, 10 enemy bodies were discovered. But Hank Hansen was dead. Like too many young boys, he died in Doc Bradley's arms. My father slipped Hank's wristwatch off, vowing to pass it on to his friend's mother. Harlan Block's tenure as the heir to Mike Strank lasted until dusk. As twilight settled in, the raw-boned Texan moved among the boys of what was now his squad, giving orders for everyone to dig in and align themselves with a good field of fire. Tex Stanton had secured himself in his foxhole when Harlan, his helmet characteristically tilted to one side, walked up to the rim and asked, "Where's Hoskins?" "Over there," Stanton replied, and then, "You'd better get down, Harlan." Then Harlan just exploded, Melvin Duncan remembered. He was blown into the air. There was dust and debris all around him. Stanton could see that Harlan had been sliced from his groin to his neck. The All-State pass catcher, the boy who'd ridden along the banks of the Rio Grande on his white horse, stood there a moment, his hands filled with a heavy redness. He gave a strangulated scream. "They killed me!" He struggled with his intestines for a moment longer, then rolled to the ground and died face down. His back, which formed one of the most galvanic contours in the flag-raising photograph, now lay limp and exposed to the setting sun. His letter to Bell, saying that he had come through without a scratch, had not yet left the island. Its postal cancellation would not be stamped until March 14th. On the day Mike and Harlan died, Congressman Joseph Hendricks of Florida stood up on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives to introduce a bill authorizing the erection of a monument. It would be a tribute to the heroic action of the Marine Corps as typified by the Marines in this photograph. "I have provided in the bill that this picture be a model for the monument because I do not believe any product of the mind of the artist could equal this photograph in action. Never have I seen a more striking photograph." At the same time, Maureen Block was imploring her mother, Belle, not to keep telling everyone that it was Harlan in the photograph at the base of the flagpole. It was just the back of a Marine. No one could be sure which one, but Belle was sure. Her reply to Maureen was a mother's. "I changed so many diapers on that boy's butt. I know it's my boy." The mission of Easy Company on March 2nd and 3rd was to advance. Their objectives were a series of low, stony ridges cut through with shallow ravines filled with piles of rubble. Japanese shooters populated these ridges, using natural cover as well as their maze of caves and tunnels. The weather turned raw and stayed that way. Rain, gusts of chilling wind. The boys clutched their ponchos and shivered. At night, the island was bathed in the lurid light of flares. Things were going off all the time, Glenn Kleckler remembered. You'd always wonder if the next one was going to fall on you. By March 3rd, some 16,000 of the original 22,000 Japanese defenders were still alive. The Americans had taken 16,000 casualties, with 3,000 dead. On this day, the 2nd Battalion's feisty Colonel Chandler Johnson, who had saved the original flag on Suribachi for his men, was blown to bits. A collarbone here, another fragment there. He was one of four of the 28th 7 officers who were killed that day. Other heroes continued to die. Sergeant Boots Thomas, who had led the thrust of the mountain's base and was interviewed on CBS Radio, took a field telephone handed to him by Phil Ward. As he answered the call, a sniper shot his rifle out of his right hand. Thomas did not flinch. The next shot ripped through his mouth, killing him instantly. The fighting was cramped and vicious. 5 men of the 5th Division were awarded the Medal of Honor on this day, a record unmatched in modern warfare. Corpsman George Wallen, 20, of Ogden, Utah, was one of those. He was finally pulled off the field after refusing to leave his comrades, even though he had suffered the third of three serious wounds. The first, a grenade blast on February 26th, had temporarily blinded him in one eye. He ignored it, as well as the other grenades that sent fragments through his butt and legs. On March 2nd, a mortar shell tore a hunk of flesh from his right shoulder. He kept on ministering to wounded men around him. Finally, on March 3rd, a mortar splintered his right leg. "I heard other guys crying for help," Wallen told me years later. "I tried to walk over to them, but couldn't. I bandaged myself up and gave myself a shot of morphine." With his foot barely attached to his leg, he crawled 50 yards to give first aid to another fallen boy before he was pulled from the battle. "Why?" I asked Medal of Honor recipient George Wallen. "Because I cared for my buddies," he answered. It was on March 4th that the lacerated, exhausted Marines saw the first demonstration of why they were fighting and dying on the ugly little island. A crippled B-29 returning from an attack on Tokyo, the Dynamite, became the first American plane to make an emergency landing on Iwo Jima. Nearby Marines watched with astonishment as the crew leaped from the aircraft and kissed the ground. The ground was shaking with artillery fire. As far as the Leathernecks were concerned, the crew had just landed in hell. They got a different perspective when one of the crewmen, thankful he had been spared a crash landing in the Pacific, shouted, "Thank God for you Marines!" Rain and chilly winds buffeted the troops that day. Bill Ganost, who had recorded the replacement flag raising with color film and who had asked Rosenthal, "I'm not in your way, am I, Joe?" walked into a secured cave to dry off. The last thing he did was turn on his flashlight. He was 38 and left behind a wife of 17 years. His body was never recovered. Joe Rosenthal landed on Guam on that day and inadvertently created the myth that his now famous photograph was staged. As he later recounted, "When I walked into press headquarters, a correspondent walked up to me. 'Congratulations, Joe,' he said, 'on that flag-raising shot on Iwo.' 'Thanks,' I said. 'It's a great picture,' he said. 'Did you pose it?' 'Sure,' I said. I thought he meant the group shot I had arranged with the Marines waving and cheering, but then someone else came up with the flag-raising picture, and I saw it for the first time. 'Gee,' I said, 'that's good, all right, but I didn't pose it. I wish I could take credit for posing it, but I can't. Had I posed the shot, I would, of course, have ruined it. I would have picked fewer men, for the six are so crowded in the picture that one of them, Sergeant Michael Strank, only the hands are visible.'" This conversation would haunt Rosenthal for the rest of his life. Some of the correspondents listening to him assumed that he was talking not about the gung-ho photograph, but about the previous frame, the one that was now famous. Soon a false and damaging slur was making the rounds that the replacement flag photograph, now universally understood as the only flag-raising photograph, was bogus, staged. Lou Lowry's shot of the original raising, delayed in its transmission to the United States, never made an impact on the public consciousness. The slur accelerated on the jealousy of some rival photographers, who were only too happy to see questions raised about the photo that had eclipsed all their work, and on the indifference of the news media about checking its facts. Time magazine, on its radio program Time Views the News, broadcast the staged interpretation of the photograph without bothering to verify the rumor. As soon as he arrived back in the States, Joe Rosenthal did his best to set the record straight. And his wire service, the Associated Press, demanded and received a public apology from Time about the error. It would be the first of many false claims, followed by press apologies. Joe Rosenthal's 1/400th-second exposure would bring him nearly as much frustration in life as it brought satisfaction. Back on the island, Don Howell had his moment of crisis and valor. Finding himself and some comrades surrounded by Japanese in an enclosed area, Howell turned himself into an acrobatic killing machine. As he ran backward over the treacherous ground, dodging bullets, he coolly slipped a belt of ammunition from his shoulder and delicately fed it into his machine gun, sprayed withering fire into the attackers as his buddies dashed to safety. This action earned Howell a Navy Cross. The Marines were taking terrible casualties, but at least one Japanese saw clearly how it would all end. General Kurabayashi sent a radio message to Tokyo. Iwo Jima would soon fall, the steely martinet reported, resulting in scenes of disaster in our empire. However, I comfort myself in seeing my officers and men die without regret after struggling in this inch-by-inch battle. My father's luck continued to hold. Sometime on March 4th, he narrowly escaped death once again. He was treating a wounded Marine in a shell hole, my father told my brother Tom, when he glanced up to see a Japanese soldier charging him with a bayonet. I shot him with my pistol, John Bradley recalled later. What did you do then? Tom asked him. I finished my job and ran to the next one. You didn't check to see if he was dead? That wasn't my job. But some of those closest to Doc were not so lucky. After this incident, Doc returned to his platoon, but he could not find his special pal, Iggy. Ralph Ignatowski had been walking with Doc just before he went to help the Marine in the shell hole. Now he was gone. Doc asked a few Marines in the area about Iggy's whereabouts. No one knew. The next day, the 2nd Battalion was relieved. Captain Severance took Easy Company back south toward Suribachi. He was taking them swimming. The gesture was pure Severance. One minute, the stern, unflappable field leader dispensing intelligent, low-key orders under heavy fire. The next, a sensitive and thoughtful shepherd of his boys, in the same mold as Mike Strank. Dave Severance would be awarded a Silver Star for his masterful guidance of Easy Company throughout the Iwo Jima invasion. Now, on the western beaches across the island from the landing side, Dave's battle-scarred kids stacked their rifles and plunged in. It must have seemed surreal to them. It does to me as I try to imagine it. A cadre of grimy, battle-hardened Marines, facing mutilation and death in their dirty foxholes, transformed in a moment to a gaggle of naked boys swimming and splashing in the ocean. While they frolicked, the March 5th edition of Time magazine headed for the newsstands. It carried the photograph, with the caption, "Old Glory on Mount Suribachi," to rank with Valley Forge, Gettysburg, and Tarawa. The boys in the ocean might have felt that they had somehow slipped off the edge of the earth into a realm far beyond the reach or knowledge of their loved ones. They would have been amazed to know the true story, that the eyes of America were upon them as they struggled. The accompanying article in Time made this clear. No battle of World War II, it declared, not even Normandy, was watched with more intensity by the U.S. people. During Easy's interlude in the Pacific surf, my father continued to wonder about Iggy. He asked around. None of the other boys had seen him lately. The mystery gnawed at him. Teamwork was encoded into the Marines' behavior. Iggy would not simply have left the company without saying something to someone, without having a reason. A less mysterious departure was that of Admiral Spruance. The naval chieftain sailed from the island on March 5th. 21 days of battle remained. The following day, Easy Company remained near the western beach. On March 7th, Easy moved out again, headed for the northern killing fields. Representative Mike Mansfield of Montana, a future ambassador to Japan, took the House floor on that day with a proposal that fired the imagination of his colleagues. A national bond tour, the 7th since the war began, was being organized to raise money for the war effort. The governmental sale of war bonds to the public had financed America's involvement in both world wars. Bond tours were elaborate coast-to-coast touring shows organized by the Treasury Department. Crowds gathered in stadiums and in roped-off city centers to hear bands play and to watch Hollywood movie stars and war heroes make pitches for the purchase of bonds. Mansfield called for the flag-raising image to be adopted as a symbol of this tour so that we as a people would do our part in keeping the flag flying at home as they have done in keeping it flying on foreign battlefields. His motion carried with great enthusiasm. On the same day, a 24-year-old Navy nurse named Norma Harrison from Mansfield, Ohio, landed on Iwo Jima. the first of 7 landings she would make there. She was a specialist in treating combat wounds in an airplane. She remembered the view as her plane circled, waiting to land. I could see the island surrounded by ships as far as the eye could see. When a battleship fired, I could feel the concussion 5,000 feet up. It was like living in a newsreel. Once she was on the ground, Norma's newsreel turned gritty. There was no time to be afraid. The wounded were in a large tent on stretchers. I had never seen such injuries. Norma and the other nurses, there were no doctors aboard, helped load the torn and broken boys onto the plane. It was noisy from the shelling, she recalled to me, but the patients were quiet. Death was quiet on those airplanes. A corpsman and I saw a guy die, and we decided not to cover him because the other guys hadn't noticed it. Those were quiet trips. Norma Harrison remembered how stunned and grateful, tickled to death, the wounded boys were to see a woman. One boy asked her if she had any lipstick. "Yes," she answered, wondering why the kid would want to know. "Would you please put some on?" the boy asked her. "I'd like to see a woman put lipstick on." Ensign Harrison would continue as a nurse for many years, in war and in civilian life. She saw many varieties of wounded and injured men. She administered to men of the Navy and the Army. But these Iwo Jima Marines would always be distinct in her memory. The difference was their spirit, she said. Not one of them was ever beaten. The Marines had esprit de corps. They were burned and injured and full of shrapnel. They were hurting, but they were never beaten. On March 8th, the Marines of Easy Company found Iggy. He had been grabbed, probably from behind, and pulled into a cave full of Japanese soldiers. As the company medic, it was my father's job to deal with what remained of Iggy's body after 3 days of brutal torture. I feel certain that the shock my young father must have experienced added greatly to his near-total silence for the rest of his life regarding his memories of the war. Chick Robeson got hit toward dusk on March 8th in the act of saving my father's life. Doc had run into the open once again to treat a wounded Marine. When he was finished, he called for covering fire. Chick and several others stood up, exposing themselves to view, and raked the ridge as Doc scurried toward them. A Japanese bullet blew Chick's BAR out of his hand and shredded his little finger. Doc was on him, patching him up almost as soon as he reached safety. Robeson later recalled that as a surgeon operated on him that night, he asked, "Son, how would you like to get off this island?" It sounded good to Chick. The 28th spent the next day clawing its way northward for about 150 yards at alternating intervals of monotony and danger. The rough terrain stripped them of tank cover. 7 men died in the 2nd Battalion. The day after that was a virtual repetition. To Representative Homer Angel of Oregon, orating elegantly on the House floor, the flag-raising photograph represented the dauntless permanency of the American spirit. Half a world away, the boys did not look so dauntless. By this point in the campaign, a point far beyond anything most troops in history had endured, the Marines' combat efficiency was showing signs of deterioration. And the boys themselves had begun to resemble ghostly remnants of a fighting force. Scruffy beards matted their faces. Their fatigues were ripped and thick with accumulated sweat. One of their number would later write that their lips were puffed and black and their mouths hung open as if they were having trouble breathing. Their daily routine, impossibly dull and impossibly terrifying, was turning them into human robots. Each day was the same, a morning artillery bombardment, then a crawling, slow advance over exposed terrain, then an afternoon bombardment, then another advance. At dusk, the boys scuttled into shell holes or ravines for shelter. The next morning, it all started over again. They had gone deeper into the dark universe of combat than anyone before them. As Richard Wheeler would later write, "The Marines were now being required to perform in a way almost beyond human endurance, both physically and psychologically. History is filled with examples of high casualties in battle, but few armies with frontline losses of over 50% have been ordered to keep attacking, especially in the face of heavy fortifications. No troops with less esprit de corps than these Marines could have kept going. One of the Marines who hardly ever betrayed a hint of the pain or the exhaustion he felt was Ira Hayes. Jack first recalled Ira as stoic and focused throughout the ordeal. "I spent a few nights with him in a foxhole," First said. "He was quiet. He never said much." Lloyd Thompson agreed. "I would shout, 'How you doing, Chief?' when I'd see him," he said. Everybody respected him as a Marine. And Phil Ward, who shared a foxhole with Ira for a week in the North, maintained, "I was glad to have him looking out for me." But sometimes even Ira's veneer cracked. Bill Rennis recalled, "One night a Japanese came close to our foxhole and Ira shot him dead. The next morning I could see sorrow on Ira's face as he looked at the dead man. He was moved." As the boys slogged through their seemingly endless operation on Iwo Jima, as they resigned themselves to the leaden permanency of an eternity spent in hell, the effects of what they had accomplished began rapidly to change the contours of the Pacific War. On March 9th, more than 300 B-29s, liberated from harassment out of Iwo's airstrips, launched the first of the great firebombing raids on Tokyo. They dropped more than 1,600 tons of incendiary bombs that destroyed 16 square miles of buildings, killed nearly 100,000 people, wounded 125,000, and left 1.2 million homeless. The casualty figures from this and other firebombing raids would be higher than those caused by the nuclear attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki 5 months later. The next day on Iwo, my father's actions once again caught the eye of Dave Severance. A man fell injured as Doc's platoon was repulsed by Japanese fire. Severance, in his report recommending my father's Navy Cross, wrote what happened next. As a second attack was launched, Bradley ran forward under the covering fire of the attacking platoon, rushed to the side of the casualty, and remained there in the midst of the enemy's tremendous volume of defensive fire until he had verified that the man had died of his wounds. The Marines inched forward on Iwo's hard shell, killed, died. On March 11th, two companies covered 25 yards and took 33 casualties. On the 12th, they were stalled with 27 casualties. It had become that kind of war. A U.S. Senator, Joseph O'Mahony of Wyoming, expressing a rising sentiment from around the country, arose in the Senate and called for a postage stamp to be issued commemorating the photograph. And on this day, Doc Bradley's war came to an end. Sam Trussell, who was wounded along with Doc, remembered it. The two were crouching at the base of a cliff with some other Marines. They thought they were protected by an overhang, but the mortar shell that got them smashed against flat rock and sent steel splinters flying. "I was blinded," Trussell recalled, "and Doc pulled me back into the hole. Then he worked on a guy whose legs were torn up. Then he guided me to the aid station. I heard some guys talking about Doc's bloody legs, but I couldn't see how bad he was hit. My father had taken shrapnel wounds to his right thigh, calf, and foot, and to his left foot. This did not stop him at first." Rolla Perry recalled glimpsing him as he ran past the enclosure. Both his legs were bleeding, but he was busily treating five other wounded Marines. Dave Severance would later write in his report on Doc that, "I observed him repeatedly running to any sector of the company's zone of action to render first aid," and that, "It would be hard to estimate the number of lives he saved by his prompt and skillful administration of medical aid, carried out with complete disregard for his own safety, nor to fully express how stimulating his devotion to duty was to the morale of those who served with him and were treated by him." Doc was rushed to the battalion aid station for emergency treatment, then on to the field hospital where some of the fragments were removed. The next morning he was loaded onto a plane for Guam, and then sent to a hospital in Hawaii. In the Pacific killing grounds, Doc Bradley was just another casualty, one of thousands. But back in the United States, millions of people were scrutinizing his profile in The Photograph, wondering who he and the other flag raisers were. The New York Sun had superimposed a drawing of the famous Spirit of 76 illustration in one corner of the photo. After it hit the newsstands, 48,000 people sent in requests for copies. The day after my father departed, René Gagnon fired his rifle for the first time. He and a buddy had wandered into a cave, assuming it was empty, a mistake that had cost many Marines their lives. The two boys found themselves facing a lone Japanese soldier with his rifle aimed at them. As he told his son, René Jr., many years later, the New Hampshire Mill kid had a blinding thought in the split second that followed. "We all have mothers. We're all human. Why does this have to be?" René had his own rifle, but he hesitated. He hoped, against all reason, that the Japanese would lay down his weapon. Instead, the enemy soldier fired. René's buddy dropped dead. In the next second, it would be René's turn. He squeezed the trigger, and the Japanese crumbled. René stood in the cave, trembling. This was what the battle had come down to. To his son, he later recalled thinking, "Why did I have to do this? Looking down a barrel into someone's eyeballs and having to kill him. There's no glory in it." Glory, though, was on the mind of Senator Raymond Willis of Indiana, who was moved by the photograph. On March 13th, Willis urged his colleagues to move with utmost haste in creating legislation to honor the all but unbelievable valor of the Marines in the Pacific. The next day, the school children of Tokyo, those who had survived the firebombing, made a special radio broadcast to the surviving defenders of the island. They sang the Song of Iwo Jima, which began, "Where dark tides billow in the ocean, a wing-shaped isle of mighty fame guards the gateway to our empire. Iwo Jima is its name." On March 14th, Admiral Nimitz proclaimed Iwo Jima conquered, and that all powers of government of the Japanese Empire in these islands are hereby suspended. 2 days later, Nimitz declared Iwo officially secured, and that organized Japanese resistance had ended. "Who does the Admiral think he's kidding?" steamed Marine Private Bob Campbell when he heard of this. "We're still getting killed." That same day, the 5th Division Cemetery, where Mike and Harlan now lay, was dedicated. Howland Mad Smith's eyes filled with tears as he said to his aide, "This is the worst yet." President Roosevelt heard of the ceremony on his way to address Congress on the Yalta summit. "The Japanese warlords know they are not being overlooked," he said in an aside to the legislators. "The Japanese know what it means that the United States Marines have landed. And I think I may add, having Iwo Jima in mind, the situation is well in hand." James Buchanan recalled those closing days a little differently. "We were trapped," he said of his unit, "getting shot at constantly. I was a private, and replacements were reporting to me. There was no one else left." On March 16th, General Kurobayashi radioed Tokyo, "The battle is approaching its end. Since the enemy's landing, even the gods would weep at the bravery of the officers and men under my command." On that same day, Louis Ruppel, the executive editor of the Chicago Herald-American, had a brainstorm. He composed it into a telegram that he sent to FDR that same day. Louis Ruppel's idea was that the flag raisers captured in Joe Rosenthal's famous photograph, which had already been designated the symbol for the 7th Bond Tour, be brought home as stars of the tour. This situation was unique. The photograph had created such a stir that the President of the United States was about to anoint the flag raisers government-approved national heroes. Yet no one knew who they were or what they had done. On March 17th, Japanese Prime Minister Kuniaki Koizo went on the radio to announce the defeat of General Kurobayashi's defenders on Iwo Jima. But the bullets and shells were still flying. Amidst all his command duties, Captain Dave Severance of Easy Company began to receive some relayed requests that at first only annoyed and distracted him. "Could he please provide the names of the Marines in the photograph?" I must confess I shared a little interest in the subject at the time, Severance told me. We were fighting for survival, covering an area big enough to engage a full company, but manned now by two small platoons commanded by corporals or sergeants. Naming the flag raisers was a subject far from my mind. By this time, newspaper clippings of the flag-raising photograph had made their way to the island. Keys Beach, a marine correspondent, was one of many journalists who saw a story in finding the flag raisers. But the easy boys who had been atop Suribachi that day were by now either casualties or scattered in the northern fighting. Only the runner, Rene Gagnon, was available to help with the identification. Rene scrutinized the blurred figures. His best guess was five names: Franklin Sousley, Mike Strank, John Bradley, himself, and Henry Hansen. Rene had determined that Hansen was the figure on the far right, ramming the pole into the ground with his back to the camera. Harlan Block and Ira Hayes were not mentioned. On March 18th, Tex Stanton, who had endured and witnessed so much travail, received his final wounds. "I was lying in my hole," he recalled to me, "where I had been for 4 days. Whenever I raised my head, they shot at me." He did not hear the round that gut him. "It was just rocks and dirt everywhere." Ira and Franklin, sharing a foxhole nearby, fell under the same mortar barrage. They saw what happened to Tex. Tex's memory of what happened next was matter of fact. "I tried to get up," he said, "and looked down and saw that both my feet were gone. But I didn't want to leave. I wanted them, the corpsmen, to leave me with my buddies." Rolla Perry, who also saw the impact, confirmed this. "I saw Stanton fly out of the hole," he said, "and when he landed, his one foot was gone and the other was dangling. It was very sad to see him without feet, trying to reach his BAR so he could keep supporting his platoon, even though most of the original men were no longer there. I had always felt safe when he was firing near me, for he was the best. When the stretcher team loaded him up and started for the rear, I heard him say, 'You can't take me away. My old buddy Perry needs me.'" As terrible as Tex's wounds were, many boys on the island would have gladly traded places with him. He had no feet, but he'd received a $1 million wound, a ticket off the island. Unlike so many who were still fighting, he would survive. The battle had become so brutal, and these teenagers so brutalized, that the sacrifice of an arm or a leg made good sense to them now. So saturated were their minds with visions of death, that when they were splashed with the blood of a stricken buddy, as so many of them were, they perceived it as a kind of hallucinatory dream. Only years after the war ended would these dreams transform themselves for some into nightmares. By March 21st, the invasion force on Iwo Jima had been attacking for 31 consecutive days, a sustained effort unique in modern warfare. Their daily mission was unchanged: move on to one more ridge. A battle for yards, feet, and sometimes even inches. Brutal, deadly, and dangerous combat aimed at an underground, heavily fortified, non-retreating enemy. 5 days of fighting remained, but no one could know that. Sleep-deprived, undernourished, inured by now to the routine of constant death, the boys shuffled forward. Their alertness, their finely tuned instinct for self-preservation, had inevitably deteriorated into a trance-like state. Perhaps that explains what happened to Franklin Sousley. Franklin had grown in battle, his comrades had observed. He'd seemed to get older and bigger. The last time L.B. Holly saw him, the young boy from Kentucky was cradling a wounded Marine between his legs as a corpsman gave first aid. A hell of a good Marine, Holly thought. A very considerate boy. But then Franklin lost his focus for just a moment. It happened at about 2:30 in the afternoon. The island had nearly been secured. Some Marines were already reboarding the transport ships offshore. General Keller E. Rocky was busy dedicating the 5th Division Cemetery, and Franklin Sousley simply wandered into a road. It was a known area of Japanese sniper fire. Perhaps Franklin forgot that. Perhaps he figured the Japanese had stopped shooting. Perhaps he was daydreaming about Marion. The shot got him from behind. As the boys around him dove to the ground, Franklin swatted absently at his back, as though brushing away a blue-tailed fly. Then he fell. Someone shouted to him, "How you doing?" And Franklin answered back, "Not bad. I don't feel anything." And then he died. The glassy-eyed Marines had been inflicting heavy enemy losses for many days, but as usual, these losses were mostly concealed from the Americans' view. But now the signs were inescapable. Final victory was near. General Kurabayashi's abandoned blockhouse was blown up on the day Franklin died. The job required 4 tons of explosives. Donald Howell, advancing with a unit at the very northern tip of the island, watched as a nearby tank aimed its flamethrower at a bunker, routing the Japanese inside. As they ran for their lives, Howell cut them down with his machine gun. "They were just piling up," he remembered. "I was shooting them as fast as they came through. I got sick to my stomach. I vomited. I was a mess for an hour and a half. It was just the thought of what you were doing to another human being. They weren't doing anything to me, and I couldn't take it. It was different than shooting someone who was threatening you." The defenders grew reckless in their desperation. Enemy infiltrators were everywhere at night now, providing easy targets for Marine sharpshooters. A bonsai charge on the night of March 22nd faltered with 50 of the 60 attackers gunned down. Area after area on the northern plateau was declared secure, each area having been won at appalling cost. "We are still fighting," Kurabayashi radioed on March 22nd. "The strength under my command is now about 400. Tanks are attacking us. The enemy suggested we surrender through a loudspeaker, but our officers and men just laughed and paid no attention." It was Kurabayashi's last dispatch. His body was never found. The next day, Frank Crow looked on as 2 surviving platoon leaders met anxiously with Dave Severance. They were murmuring about the losses and about the inability to finish off the enemy, Crow recalled. They intimated that they and their men were about at the end of their rope. The captain listened to them, and quietly gave orders for the next day's fighting. His calm manner had a strong effect. The feeling of hopelessness changed to one of quiet resolve. The tall, dignified captain was a good deal more ravaged than he appeared. He had received word from home that day that his wife had given birth to a stillborn baby boy. Sometime later, Severance learned the bad news about a corporal in his platoon, one Dave Bowman, whose wife also was expecting. Bowman was giving a final briefing to the platoon leader who was relieving him so that he could head for the offshore transport and passage back home. As he talked, he was shot dead. This was too much for Severance. "I went off to an area all by myself and cried," he told Richard Wheeler. "I eventually regained my composure and moved on." 3 days after that, the war was over for Easy Company. Easy's original total force on Iwo Jima was 310 young men, including replacements. On March 26th, Captain Severance led his 50 survivors on a tour of the newly dedicated 5th Division Cemetery. And then they traveled by a small boat to the transport, the Winged Arrow, for the trip back home. They had to climb a cargo net to get aboard. Many were so weak that they had to be pulled over the rail by sailors. When I asked Severance many years later exactly how it finally ended, he thought for a moment and then replied, "We had all the real estate." Severance was the only one of 6 Easy Company officers to walk off the island. Of his 3rd platoon, the one that first scaled Suribachi, only Harold Keller, Jim Michaels, Phil Ward, and Grady Dice came through the battle untouched. Easy Company had suffered 84% casualties. Of the 18 triumphant boys in Joe Rosenthal's gung-ho flag-raising photograph, 14 were casualties. The hard statistics show the sacrifice made by Colonel Johnson's 2nd Battalion. 1,400 boys landed on D-Day. 288 replacements were provided as the battle went on. a total of 1,688. Of these, 1,511 had been killed or wounded. Only 177 walked off the island. And of the final 177, 91 had been wounded at least once and returned to battle. It had taken 22 crowded transports to bring the 5th Division to the island. The survivors fit comfortably onto 8 departing ships. The American boys had killed about 21,000 Japanese, but suffered more than 26,000 casualties doing so. This would be the only battle in the Pacific where the invaders suffered higher casualties than the defenders. The Marines fought in World War II for 43 months, yet in 1 month on Iwo Jima, one-third of their total deaths occurred. They left behind the Pacific's largest cemeteries, nearly 6,800 graves in all, mounds with their crosses and stars. Thousands of families would not have the solace of a body to bid farewell. Just the abstract information that the Marine had died in the performance of his duty and was buried in a plot aligned in a row with numbers on his grave. Mike lay in plot 3, row 5, grave 694. Harlan in plot 4, row 6, grave 912. Franklin in plot 8, row 7, grave 2189. When I think of Mike, Harlan, and Franklin there, I think of the message someone had chiseled outside the cemetery. When you go home, tell them for us and say, for your tomorrow, we gave our today. Most of the Japanese dead lay sealed in caves where they would become mummified by sulfur fumes. Decades later, many would be found perfectly preserved, their eyeglasses still on. Some survived and fought on. One who surrendered months after the Marines left later emigrated to Brazil, too ashamed to live in Japan. The last two defenders surrendered in 1949. In the 1,364 days from Pearl Harbor to the Japanese surrender, with millions of Americans fighting on global battlefronts, only 353 Americans were awarded Medals of Honor, the nation's highest decoration for valor. Marines accounted for 84 of these decorations, with an astonishing 27 awarded for just 1 month's action on Iwo Jima, a record unsurpassed by any battle in U.S. history. Iwo Jima stands as America's most heroic battle. The American victory unquestionably hastened the end of the war. In the ensuing months, about 2,400 distressed B-29 bombers carrying 27,000 crewmen would make emergency life-saving landings on the island. This knowledge provided some comfort to the boys who had fought on Iwo Jima. Some. We who survived to the end were lucky, said Robert McEldowney. Just lucky. It wasn't a matter of living or dying or fighting, said Corpsman Robert DeGus. It was a matter of helping your friends. Tell your readers, Corpsman William Hoops advised me, that I was wearing Marine Corps green dungarees. Mine were stiff with dried blood, and they cracked. And it wasn't my blood. To Tex Stanton, it was an island of heroes. If you got a medal, he said, your citation read that you did something above and beyond the call of duty. Well, I saw plenty of heroes on that island, and I figure if you spent just 24 hours there, you were doing something above and beyond just to survive. One of the last things Danny Thomas did before leaving the island was find Chick Harris's grave. Chick and Danny had been the Buttermilk Boys, the two friends who were too young to drink liquor on Liberty. Danny had run past his severed, dying pal on D-Day. Now Danny knelt beside the place where Chick lay buried and made a silent promise. A promise that had nothing to do with wars or flags or nations or the century of the Pacific that the Battle of Iwo Jima had forged. I promised I'd drink a toast of buttermilk to him, Danny said. Chapter 14. Antigo. Where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day. Home on the Range. I knew nothing of all this growing up in Antigo. I knew almost nothing of it until after my father's death in 1994. World War II had been over less than 10 years when I was born, yet from a boy's perspective in this small, tree-shaded town, it might as well have been fought in the Middle Ages. A vivid, glorious, exciting story filled with images of great battleships and planes and tanks and men charging forth in rounded helmets, all backgrounded somehow by the stars and stripes. Vivid and glorious, but already distant. A kind of myth. I played soldier with my neighborhood friends and sang from the halls of Montezuma and thrilled to all the war movies on TV. As I grew a little older, I devoured history books. I learned all about Eisenhower and MacArthur, but I never linked any of this to my own life or my father's life. My brothers and sisters didn't either. The Allied Expeditionary Force, Spearhead, these were about as connected to Antigo as Benny Goodman or Betty Grable. The sense of distance was a little strange, of course, given that we all knew early on that our father was a figure in the most famous war photograph ever made. But that's all we knew. Our father himself never mentioned the photograph. He didn't encourage anyone else to mention it. No copies of it existed in the house. The names Mike, Harlan, Ira, Franklin, and Renee were unknown to us, as was the name Iggy. And so the war and the photograph floated at the edges of my childhood, somewhere between reality and distant dream. This was real. We lived at 321 Fifth Avenue in the second largest house in town, a black-shuttered white-frame house that felt as though it had been there for all time and would continue there for all time. With three squat stories and a big front yard crowned by an old maple tree, and the backyard where we played football and catch-one, catch-all. And this was real. Our dad was the owner of the McCandless, Zobel, and Bradley funeral home and one of Antigo's leading citizens. We never thought to wonder why Dad's name came last on the funeral home's name, given that he was the sole owner. It was just part of the way things were. Like our garage full of bikes, or the old St. John's Church and St. John's Catholic School, where Dad had gone as a little boy 2 blocks away, or the Antigo River 2 blocks in another direction. Real things. Timeless things. Things that just were. My father had come home from the war and looked up his third-grade sweetheart, Elizabeth Van Gorp of Appleton, and married her in May of 1946 and moved with her to Milwaukee, where he worked at a funeral home while studying mortuary science. They set up housekeeping in a chauffeur's quarters above a four-stall garage. In 1947, their first child, Kathy, was born, and John heard of an opening in the Muttert McGillen Funeral Home in Antigo. He brought Betty and the baby to his hometown. He probably carried all the money he owned in his pocket. 7 years later, at the age of 32, he was able to make one of the biggest commercial purchases in the county's history, the McCandless and Zobel Funeral Home. He got on the front page of the Antigo Daily Journal with that purchase. Before long, people in town were calling it the Bradley Funeral Home, but officially it was McCandless, Zobel, and Bradley. Dad kept those original names in it as long as he owned the business, nearly 40 years. McCandless and Zobel meant something to the history of the town, to its memory of itself. That was more important to John Bradley than advancing his own name. Dad bought the funeral home along about my first birthday, in February 1955. I was the fourth of the 8 Bradley kids. Before me, there were Kathy, Steve, and Mark. Afterward, we were joined by Barbara, Patrick, Joe, and Tom. I still have my birth bill from the hospital on a wall in my study. John Bradley paid it in full the month after I was born. I cost $71.90. Our house on Fifth Avenue must have been built in the 1910s. It looked like it could survive a nuclear attack. It featured a big formal living room, a big formal dining room, a den, and a family room. The sunroom had a stone floor with a radiator underneath it. Ours was a real working household. Everybody pitched in. We all had special tasks. When I was a little boy, my special task in winter was to get up every morning at 5 a.m. and go look outside the window to see if it had snowed. I had a particular window on the second floor where my bedroom was that was just right for this. It gave me a view to the telephone lines. There often was 3 feet of older snow already on the ground at 5 o'clock in the morning, and sometimes it was hard to tell if fresh snow had fallen, but I always could. If I focused on the telephone lines, even in the dark, I could see whether they supported thin, parallel lines of fresh snow. If there was fresh snow, I'd wake my two older brothers and we'd bundle up and set out on foot down to the funeral home, about a 6-block walk, often through unplowed streets. There we'd get to work with our shovels. The funeral home was a large corner property, and we had a lot of pavement to shovel off. A sidewalk, the large stair-stepped entrances, the huge parking lot. It was all manual labor. There were a few little gasoline-powered snowplows back then. We'd arrive before sunup and work our way through what seemed like tons of snow. And after we were finished there, we got to come back to the house and do the walk in the driveway. 2 big snow-shoveling jobs before school. Only then could we dive into breakfast. The French toast, pancakes, and eggs Mom would have ready for us. But it was fun. We never questioned it, never complained. It was part of Dad and Mom's system. They never called it that, but it existed. And I think it was brilliant. Brilliant and necessary. My parents had 8 children to raise and a business to run, so as each of us got older, we took on a new level of responsibility. Washing the dishes, keeping the lawn mowed, helping out with the house cleaning, it was never something we complained about or tried to negotiate. We just did it, because that was the way the family ran. We helped one another. We were a functioning, interdependent unit. It was our duty. I think that Dad incorporated this concept of a system into his whole life, though if you put it to him that way, he wouldn't recognize it. He saw his role in the funeral business as being one of service. People always ask what it was like being a funeral director's son. Did you see a lot of dead bodies? Did you have to watch them get embalmed? It was never like that. My dad wasn't an embalmer. He had assistants who did that. He was a diplomat. He was a psychiatrist, a psychologist, a counselor. If you lived around Antigo and your father died, you called John. If you had a problem with the Social Security Administration, John would help you with that. You didn't know how you were going to pay that doctor bill? John Bradley would have a plan. He focused on the needs of the families. Very often he would work until 10 o'clock at night. He'd come home for dinner, take a short nap, and then go back. Nights were when the wakes occurred. He could have had an assistant handle those, but he was nearly always there himself. He would stand at the top of the stairs inside the entrance to the funeral home, greeting the people who came to mourn. He knew an astonishing number of these people by name. People from out of town, people he hadn't seen in years, would brighten a little when he not only hailed them by name, but inquired about personal details they'd forgotten they'd told him. Marriages, illnesses, newborn children. This must have required some effort on my father's part, but I'm sure it was never a strain. And it was never insincere. Ever. He cared about these people, their struggles and triumphs, their opinions. And the people sensed his caring. I remember the first time I went on a call with my father to pick up a deceased person. I was about 12 years old. Dad said, "Okay, we're going in that house and we're going to pick up this lady. There'll be family in there and they'll be crying." And then he said, "I just want you to act as if that is your mother you are picking up. We're going to treat her like she's your mother." In the same spirit of service, my dad was president of just about everything in his hometown. School board, PTA, Lions, Elks. He was just a leader. But it benefited his business, too. He built one of the larger funeral homes in the state of Wisconsin, which is very close to impossible to do when you're in the small town of Antigo. But then John Bradley was the funeral director of choice for counties around. He cut a dignified figure in the town, but there was no vanity connected to his elegance. After he died, my mom gave me a money clip of his that bore his initials, J.H.B. She commented that a salesman must have given it to him, because it would have been too flashy for him to have his initials inscribed. I countered, "But Mom, Dad had tailor-made suits, tailor-made coats, beautiful shoes. He always spent on his appearance." She answered, "Yes, but that was for the business. He had to look good for his business." She was right. All his life he drove new Cadillacs, but those shiny new cars were used at the funeral home. After he retired, he drove the smallest, least-equipped Chevy station wagon. He ran his funeral home with a total commitment to quality and service. Everything was spotless, meticulously maintained. Once when I was working there, he told me to clean the car that had just been used to deliver leftover flowers to the nursing homes. I cleaned and cleaned and shined and shined. At last, I proudly announced that it was ready for his inspection. My dad walked to the garage, his wingtips crunching the tiny stones on the blacktop. He opened the back door, raised the floor, took the spare wheel out, and pointed to a single flower petal. "I thought you said this was clean," he said. I got the message. I thought that was fair, clean to the highest standards. And the highest standards had to be met when dealing with the public. It wasn't about subservience or projecting a false image. It was about rendering true service. He didn't articulate it, but you understood that people were important. They deserved respect. My dad's natural leadership set an unspoken standard in the household. My older brothers were presidents of their class. In grade school and high school, the morning announcements were often read by a Bradley. The spokesperson for the school was a Bradley. I was president of my class for 6, 7 years in a row. It was an assumed thing. The Bradleys were leaders. Dad never seemed to cultivate his leadership. He led a conservative life. He was not a star in any sense, but everyone liked John Bradley. Maybe part of his secret was that people felt safe talking to him. Maybe it was because of the way he listened to them. Those big ears of his that got even more prominent toward the end of his life were more than mere decoration. He was a believing, practicing Catholic. He went to Mass every Sunday. He confessed his sins. He believed the dogma. Jeepers Christmas was the worst oath he ever swore. Church for him was a bright, soothing presence. The priests were figures of respect. The sacraments marked births and adulthood and death. All of it was straightforward, practical, solid. Just like John Bradley. We all knelt down and said the rosary. It wasn't that Dad insisted we do these things. He never spoke to us about faith. But his actions always spoke louder than words. His actions, in fact, the day-to-day actions of his long, quiet, worshipful life, as a pillar of the Antigo community, spoke so loudly that the words we all wanted to hear never broke the surface, the words that would explain to us what the war had been like for him, what Iwo Jima had been like, and what it was like to have been a figure in the photograph. This was the way John Bradley wanted it. His actions would be what defined him to us. The words we sought would have to come from someplace else. For decades, for an entire generation, those words remained unspoken. And so they grew unimportant, at least most of the time. We all knew about the photo, but we knew of no story behind it to give it meaning for us. Statues had been made with John Bradley's figure in them, but my father wore no statue-shaped belt buckles. He lit no cigarettes with a statue-shaped lighter. His Navy Cross he kept out of sight. None of us knew he had been awarded it until after he had died. Neither I nor any of my 5 brothers and 2 sisters ever read a book about Iwo Jima while my father was alive. How could we be so incurious? It wasn't ineptitude. We knew how to obtain facts. We understood how to use libraries. As we grew older, we all attended universities with their great resources. How could we have persisted in this state of not knowing? The answer, I think, lies in the attitude of unimportance my father projected toward the subject. The subject, for him, could never merely be the Battle of Iwo Jima. Always would have to be complicated, adulterated by his unwanted fame as one of the flag raisers. Thus it became unimportant. Importantly unimportant. Reading a book on Iwo Jima at home would have been like reading a Playgirl magazine, my sister Barbara remarked once. It would have been something I had to hide. And so it was only outsiders, strangers, who brought the subject up with him. Mostly these were the newspaper and broadcast reporters who phoned once a year, every year, in early February, near the anniversary of the flag raising. Dad never expressed anger or exasperation to these annoying inquirers. One of his strategies for avoiding that was to enlist us, his family, in handling as many of them as possible. We were trained never to put our father on the line when the calls came in. Instead, we were to tell the television networks and national newspapers that John Bradley was unavailable, fishing in Canada. My father never went fishing in Canada. Often, as we gave this excuse, he was sitting across the table from us. I don't remember him ever articulating why he did not want to speak to the callers. The best he could do was to give a barely perceptible shake of his head as if he were dealing with a common inconvenience like hay fever or nearsightedness. It was his personal affliction. Or call it his aberration, that 1/400th of a second that welded him to a national fantasy. My father was a man firmly anchored to the world of real things, real values. He had no interest in theorizing, conjecture, high-blown sentiments.
End of Disc 8.